I'm not getting any third or fourth screen images. Am I broken?
So what we define here in our sort of shop lingo of Fire Casino talk as third screen, for those not paying attention to the glossary, is photorealistic images that are perfectly lifelike and maybe moving and interactive. And then fourth screen would be where you're actually in a place that is photorealistic and interactive as if you're immersed in it. These experiences are A, not necessary for profound insights or genic experiences or other psychological things or lots of fun. B, some people are more prone to getting into them than others for reasons unknown, even if they're strong practitioners. C, somewhat rare, even in people who might be very strong practitioners. And D, relatively unpredictable a lot of the time. It is true that there's a correlation between very strong, very well-developed concentration and these kinds of experiences arising. But that said, taking them as some sort of either badge of honor or from their lack, sense of failure or brokenness, neither of those are helpful. The second screen and the Merc are plenty interesting enough to have tons of fascinating experiences and really where most of the party is.
It's easy in the beginning to think that solving the Merc or making the Merc more developed will also solve the second screen, and then what graduates to the third screen, and then, you know, you're seeing dragons and all of that. But really, the second screen is where all of it happens. It's where the vast majority of my experience was. In the beginning, I would only glimpse the third screen and only on the way to sleep. There's something that supercharges the hypnagogic imagery that one sees on the way to sleep when doing this practice, and especially in high doses. But even then, they would be 1 second glimpses of random photorealistic images. It's also important, at least for me, the third screen feels like a fundamentally different space at first. It feels closer to daydreaming space. And I imagine that something like the fourth screen is closer to dreaming space, a really immersive experience like that. And so to look for the third screen on the second screen, or to look for the cracks in the second screen that lead to the third screen, might be frustrating if you take that too literally or push that too hard.
Is practicing magic skillful?
In traditional Buddhist texts, if you look at texts such as the Fruits of the Homeless Life, the Buddha frankly advertised powers as one of the things that you could get as a beneficial effect and advertising point of becoming a monk or nun in his order. Furthermore, the texts are absolutely filled with examples of the Buddha and his followers performing magical acts and cultivating powers. Furthermore, the texts are absolutely chock-a-block filled with instructions for exactly how to do this. And the Buddha himself highly praised those people who had developed various powers, in fact, calling them out specifically and naming them and praising them for the powers that they had developed. While they are not considered entirely compatible with a Western rational, materialist, scientific, you know, respectable Protestant paradigm, that said, they're a fascinating thing to try to cultivate. The degree of concentration it takes to cultivate them is actually very meritorious and beneficial on its own. What you learn about yourself when you try to cultivate them, and even when you experience them, is hard to learn in any other way. And the rich psychological, mythical, deep subconscious sort of Jungian archetypal journey you go on when you get into this stuff is just absolutely fascinating, revealing, and incredibly worthwhile.
It's also worth asking what magic is, what magic means to you, how expansive is your view of magic. A lot of the things that were most magical to me about doing casino practice over lengthy period of time at high doses was the things like jhanic factors, being able to call them up or cultivate them or really bring them strongly into experience. That seemed downright magical to me, more so than drawing really sophisticated images. The way the world can look after a day of doing kasina practice in the twilight or in the gloaming, when the visuals that you've been seeing with eyes closed all day kind of come alive, that can be a very magical experience. And it's really worth considering what you think magic is and how expansive your view of it is.
I'd like to add to that. I am one of those folks with that Western rational scientific mind. And frankly, I came into this retreat thinking that magic was BS and had a dinner conversation to that very effect the night before. And I certainly don't have the concentration to perform any of the magic that the Buddha talked about, but it really transformed into a childlike wonder and playfulness, a sense of anything is possible, this is really fun. And that really transformed the experience for me.
Dana, it was useful when you mentioned the thing about like something outside of causality. It was useful when you talked about how whatever that is, kind of Western whatever paradigm. Could you explain that again? That was useful.
I actually don't remember what I said at all.
Okay, you said something about, okay, so there's this Western paradigm that says, okay, this is how things are. There are causal things that are out of that paradigm, and they don't count, but they're causal. That was very useful for me with somewhat of that, you know, inclination towards viewing things in that kind of Western way. It helped contextualize magic for me.
Yeah, so basically, there are all kinds of things that would not be considered real, such as visions or dreams, or a shape you drew in the air or in some color with your finger, or an entity you interacted with, or a voice that you heard, or a travel out of body that you experienced, or whatever other premonition or thing you chanced into, hearing things or knowing things that you otherwise seemingly couldn't. All of those things from a sort of very strict scientific, scientism, materialist worldview might not be considered real, quote unquote, but they are certainly causal elements within this system. And to have a definition of real that excludes things that are clearly causal, not only did conditions cause them, but they also have effects on the rest of the quote unquote real system. That's a pretty weak definition of reality and clearly fundamentally incomplete, flawed, missing something and pretty bizarre in its desire to exclude things that are clearly part of the system.
Yeah, well, I think much of insight comes from like loosening up and kind of wrecking our fixed views and seeing magic and then the real world, and then it kind of like fades in, fades out, and kind of distort each other. There's a lot of really legit insight there.
How does experimenting with image and color control help produce insights into intention?
By figuring out the iterative process by which we create the things that we see, the color washes, the images, the whatever it is, there's a part of our mind that is constantly iterating like or dislike. Oh, that's kind of cool or that's not cool. Initially, it seems way more random and unstructured, but there's actually something about what we're doing with attention and intention, as well as judgment and creativity, that is creating the strange stuff we see. Initially in the murk, it's very, very vague and sort of mysterious, almost black boxy. Why do these things do that? Why does it take so long for any intention to even have the teeniest little hint of effect? But as we start to play more and more in that territory, we begin to wake up parts of our brains that initially were very mysterious. We begin to see our subtle judgments and likes and dislikes. We begin to see the creativity that starts to associate an image with a shape, and then it becomes more like that shape. We begin to see the real moment-to-momentness of that, because it's happening pretty fast. And that is waking up parts of our experience that then have the possibility of also being insight objects. So if these parts of our experience that are creating our reality and modifying our reality are not well perceived, we can't gain insight into them. But by working with image and color and even movement control and other things like sort of the stereoscopic aspects of things and control, the very, you know, how wide our attention is control. By working with those things very consciously, we actually bring those processes up in volume and up in consciousness, and they become not black boxy, but something we're actually clearly enough experiencing to have real insights into those things from a classical point of view.
And adding to that, intention is really, really close. And if we can see through intention, that can facilitate seeing through much of what we think is us. What is
self. The sense of agency.
Yeah.
When should I back off and when shouldn't I back off?
Back off of the practice if things start getting too weird. If you feel unsafe or unwell, then that's a good time to back off any practice. You have to really be honest with yourself about what your tolerance is, not only for weird stuff, but for more intense insight stages. Generally, you should back off when things start feeling to the point where you are overwhelmed and you can't handle it. When a good opportunity to kind of gauge where you are related to earlier topics of mind wandering, you can kind of lean into the meditation more and really ask yourself, am I really involved with what's going on in the visual field? Or am I just kind of looking at it? Am I just floating it in? Or am I really paying close attention? That can be a way of backing on and really leaning into it and kind of upping concentration to be more crisp and more constant.
If you're worried about if you need to back off and things are getting too weird, definitely go walk. Walking is very grounding.
I think I might have had an arising and passing away event once or twice during this retreat, and I was given the advice to practice more and project less. And so I was expecting challenging mental situations, and it sounded like at that time the actual best advice was actually to practice more. Perhaps you might elaborate?
It's a really complicated topic, and it is true that some people, by practicing more, will get out of difficult stages and get into equanimity, or will develop the concentration that keeps their mind from wandering, or will then get into cool territory that gets them back into fascination and out of blame or projection or anger or sadness or fear or whatever it is, you know, or psychosis or whatever they're going through. That said, there are also some people that more practice is just going to take them from the runway to liftoff to crazy land, and that's not where they need to be. And so it is not always predictable what practice is going to do to any individual person, and it really depends a lot on that moment and a lot on how they practice and conceptualize a practice and other factors that are hard to predict. So I wish it were perfectly like there was, it was all science and no art, but there is clearly, unfortunately, still some art to figuring out what's going to be the best advice for any person, because the future is unknown and there are surprising twists to this path that can show up.
That can be the really helpful thing about having someone that you're checking in with on a daily basis. If they recommend that you back off, it's a really good idea to listen.
Would this be a useful question in this area? If my mental state has any touches of psychosis, definitely back off. If it doesn't, maybe consider pushing forward. I don't know.
But it depends on how you define psychosis. So if you heard a benevolent voice that just said, hey, you're a great person, that's some people's psychosis, and other people just like, oh, cool, I got a little divine ear. You have to be careful with how you define psychosis, but when you're getting into territory of malignant entities or malignant voices or command hallucinations or whatever those things, some people handle those well and they're just like, oh, cool, another interesting object that I'm not going to react strangely to, or I'm not going to do any weird behaviors around. And it's just something that they're like, oh, another chance to practice loving kindness and equanimity. And other people, those same experiences that, you know, they might call psychosis are really going to throw them tremendously out of behaviors that are going to be safe or reasonable or skillful relationships to people or those experiences. And so the problem is, not only do you have to be careful with how you define psychosis, but you also have to watch what your reactions to those strange experiences are. And there's a big gray area there, but certainly if you're risking anything unsafe, then you've got a serious problem that needs help, you know, and grounding down and backing off and all of that stuff. But it's complicated.
What to do about entities, particularly harmful ones?
Fierce Guru with Purba.
So for those who are not familiar with what that means, that's a very specific tantric practice that is designed to handle unskillful entities and forces. But for those who don't have that particular somewhat unusual empowerment, A, definitely be keeping friends who have their wits about them and experience in this territory, at least, you know, experience with mental health, or at least just a good, you know, sane head on their shoulders in the loop is of tremendous value. And then schools of thought on how to handle demons vary widely. I am way towards the side of things like laughter, loving kindness practices, sort of gentle equanimity, asking them what they want, recognizing their suffering, having compassion for them, teaching them the Dharma, explaining the karmic consequences of unskillful actions and how to have skillful ones such that they attain a better rebirth. That's way more my style. But there are plenty of other valid styles that might totally work, such as command exorcisms in the traditional sense, just totally ignoring them, telling them to fuck off, like, excuse my language, stopping practicing until those experiences go away, skillful distraction, watching funny YouTube cat videos. I can imagine a wide range of skillful responses that are not harming and that are beneficial.
What to do if I see unsettling images?
I just be with it and roll on.
I always take the approach that unsettling images are simply mind-generated and to just relax and basically ignore them. They're just simply projections of my own mind.
I would sometimes invite in the presence of a very safe, supportive, protective being to be with me, to keep me company when there were more frightening images coming up.
You can also investigate the feeling of unease, or if stronger feelings such as fear or even terror are coming up, you can investigate those as well. You can also keep in mind that disturbing imagery can be an effect of being through some of the more difficult insight stages in the third Vipassana jhana. That's the way that it might manifest, especially during the kasina, which is such a visual practice.
In some of my shamanic practices, I've learned very quickly that the first 10 seconds of your response to something like that coming up is critical. And if you allow yourself to get overwhelmed or triggered in that first 10 seconds, you get a big dump of adrenaline or something, cortisol or stress hormones in the body, and it's going to suck for the next 15 minutes. You just have to kind of ride that out. And so when those images first arise, meeting them skillfully, I think it'd be very powerful. And if you find that you still get overwhelmed by them, you might just need a break until the chemicals kind of come out of your body.
It's also worth remembering with doing a concentration practice like this, that concentration is essentially a neutral force. And if you point strong concentration at something unpleasant, it's going to amplify that. And so you really have to practice a tighter degree of control if you know that you're getting up into high concentration areas, that when something like this arises, you don't lean into it, amplify it, and make things worse.
Actually, Daniel, when you talked about the dark jhanas, that was really helpful for me to hear about.
What Cedric's talking about is that concentration can take anything as object. And once our concentration gets strong, if we become frightened, fear is frightening. And we can become more frightened by fear. And a concentrated mind can amplify that. If the sensations of fear, the images of fear, the thoughts of fear, the adrenaline that comes out with fear is what our mind takes as object before we've learned to direct our powerful concentrated mind a little better, then we can get into what I call dark jhana, where in regular jhana, you take a positive mental factor like bliss or tranquility or equanimity And that holds concentration because it's a positive quality and our minds like positive qualities. And so it reinforces the concentration, you know, and because the concentration is stronger on a positive quality, the positive quality gets stronger. And we set up that feedback loop of generating depth of concentration in just the same way, because fear is frightening or misery is miserable or whatever, disgust is, you know, makes us irritable and angry and prone to disgust, then we can similarly, once we've gotten our minds concentrated, amplify those powerful dark feelings, which is unskillful in general and usually doesn't go well. And so as soon as we recognize that we're creating what I call dark jhana or amplifying unskillful mind states, we need to grab a hold of the reins and redirect to anything else, even something neutral, if you possibly can, to something positive. And just recognize that once we've developed a concentrated mind, we need to use it very responsibly and direct it properly, just like a acetylene cutting torch. Very, very useful for cutting through delusion. But if you direct it wrong, you can just cut your arm off.
When in doubt, go to metta, go to compassion.
In terms of the frightening images, I actually found it really helpful when I would be cycling through the jnanas, the insight knowledge of fear. It was so easy for me to identify that one by the color. For me, the fear jnana always has a green background with purple on top. And when it became more formed into some kind of image, it would often be eyes looking, very creepy looking eyes that would form out of that green purple interplay. And it was just so helpful for me to be able to start to see the pattern as I would cycle through that particular jnana. That creepy kind of imagery would come up very consistently.
What to do if I start hearing voices, particularly malevolent ones?
So as we discussed earlier, if you're hearing malevolent voices and you're handling them well, and to you, they're just another sound, they're just something interesting, they're not throwing you off your game, they're one more object of insight to see their impermanence or to just take as another curious quirk of the path, then that's no problem. But if you're hearing malevolent voices or command hallucinations or that kind of stuff, and you're having a reaction that's like, oh, I really think I should do what those voices are saying, or, oh my God, those are totally freaking me out, or, oh my golly, I think I'm losing my mind, or any of those reactions that are less equanimous, skillful, you know, humorous, then that is definitely a moment when you need to be telling people and talking to them and backing way the heck off on the practice, because it could make things worse if you continue to cultivate a practice that is designed to see and hear things that other people often might not think is there. If it gets way worse and you start thinking you're a danger to self or others, you should just seek immediate psychiatric stabilization through the standard professional channels.
How do I deal with psychological content when it comes up?
You can always investigate it. And you can always look for elements of the psychological content that have a footprint or signature in the body. So if a painful emotion comes up, you might look for where in the body you feel something that seems to be related to that. It can be a little bit mysterious how to connect something like an emotion, or even something even more subtle, sometimes like a thought, to a physical signature. But if you work with it and play with it and intend it, you can often find something that you can then pull into the meditation, and you can balance that physical sensation with whatever is going on in the visual field, or with whatever is going on with any of the sense doors that you want to add to the mix. So investigating it and really kind of trying to find a way to involve it in the meditation can be one way to really work with it, even if it's difficult or painful.
I have a long history of dealing with deep traumas arising during meditation, which is in fact one of the reasons why I like to meditate, and recognizing them as simply parts of my mind that haven't been accessed, haven't been purified yet. And what a profound opportunity. How glad I am for this to be arising, and how relieving it could be if I can just meet it with equanimity. I think it was Shinzen Young, I guess, who said that purification is equal to pain times equanimity. And I had a Chiladasa once said to me, as this stuff is arising, if you begin to find it overwhelming, never forget who and where you are. And I can think of two of the most profoundly painful things that arose in my meditative career, and simply opening my eyes and finding myself in a kuti or finding myself in a room full of meditators instantly popped the trauma, and it was outpouring of just beautiful emotion. And that was really quite profound for me. Also just really meeting it with compassion, that like meeting it as this wounded part of self, and really just kind of inviting it to reunify with the rest of the mind that had been this part that had been pearled off and was painful, and actually visualizing that little soap bubble popping into the fuller, bigger bubble of mind and seeing that unify and hugging it like a child was extremely powerful for me.
One thing I've really enjoyed on this retreat is practicing with such a wide range of expertise. And it was just fantastic to be able to seek out other practitioners who have a lot of strength in working with this material and just getting really creative ideas on how to go deeper with it when I felt enough emotional and mental stability to really take that harder material on and work with it.
There's a series of exercises called trauma or tension release exercises, popularized by David Bracelli. I've had retreats that lasted, you know, 2 weeks or more where I use these exercises every day, quite for long periods of time. Found that they really pulled up a lot, but they also seem to process a lot. So a series of exercises that wear out your lower body and then kind of shake out your psoas, which is where we hold so much of our tension and trauma. I also found in this retreat that doing a lot of really deep breathing exercises, really stretching the limits of how much I thought I could inhale or exhale, practicing the types of things that might increase heart rate variability for those into those sorts of things, made dealing with difficult emotions easier, but also brought more to the surface for me to get to work with and purify.
And then there's always the fact that the colors and images are safe. They're not going to hurt you. The mantra is safe. It's not going to hurt you. There are jhanic qualities one can just pull in. And while I don't ever mean to encourage what, you know, is routinely called spiritual bypassing, we don't always have to take everything on the moment it arises. We don't always have to plunge into the depths of our pain full on. There are ways to ride out some of these strange stages actually just in realms of light and sound that are very clean and beautiful, and is another way of handling these things. So I think it's good to have a range and recognize that the various focuses you can take provide optionality, and you can see for yourself what seems to work best in each moment.
I think retreat time is so precious. Sometimes when certain psychological stuff comes up, it can derail your practice for one thing, but you know, you can have a choice. Well, do I deal with this now, or maybe this is something that I should wait until after the retreat, talk to somebody. You know, I think a lot of times stuff comes up for a reason, and it's not good to simply ignore it. At least I don't get much time to dedicate just to meditation. And so for the most part, I think making a date for later to deal with that stuff and finding other ways to just get back to the meditation object is probably the most helpful thing.
On the other hand, I've had retreats where I felt incredibly neurotic and judged the retreats and didn't feel like I was making any progress. And then in my daily life, a month or two later, I said, wow, things are really different. And on the following retreat, it was a totally different timbre. And so I think actually being able to face the neurosis and become familiar with it and get to see it for what it really is can in and of itself be a very powerful practice if you can manage to sit with it.
I found that if I attempted to just let the psychological material fade into the background and it came back stronger and continued to come back even stronger, that was a good sign that there was probably something there that I needed to work through before getting back to the fire casino.
How do I manage expectations, judgment, and comparison with other reports and practitioners skillfully?
It's very important to recognize that this is going to be very much your own journey. And your journey is the most important thing for your practice. Comparison can be incredibly toxic for some people. Expectation can pull you away from the present moment. It is not that people can't sometimes gain inspiration from the accomplishments of others in the sense of, oh, they did it, I can do it too. Oh, wow, this practice has the potential to lead to that. That renews my interest and our energy. So people can have various reactions to comparison. Some people take this as kind of like a playful sport and a little bit of friendly competition really gets their energy motivated and it's just fine. Other people in that same circumstance might become full of self-loathing or judgment or doubt or become incapacitated by their ability to accept what is going on in their own practice rather than what they think should be going on. And so you really have to look at yourself and which of those you are and figure out how to deal with the unskillful aspects of those reactions if they're coming up. You could try just noting comparison, noting analysis, just try ignoring the other reports, figure out what strategy works well for you. But it is clear that comparison of these emotions are a double-edged sword and can cut both ways.
It's also an opportunity to practice appreciative joy when you hear the reports of others. As, you know, if they're reporting something really exciting or they're just thrilled with what they've experienced, it's one of the Brahma Viharas, appreciative joy.
But there's a reason it's considered the hardest of the four. It's because we tend to be jealous, envious, comparative creatures.
Nominally, I would say lower your expectations. Remember that people tend to report peak experiences. Remember that the early days of practice can be met with some early successes that then don't seem to continue. And that you will read a lot of fascinating things about what is possible in the fire casino, but that almost all of those come with extended amounts of practice and don't account for a lot of time spent looking at what many people would consider very boring. In a deeper sense, I would say that be willing to be surprised. Just to give one example, a lot of the visuals that I saw would probably be considered mundane by most standards, particularly to outsiders. But because they were mundane, little differences in the colors and the shapes and the movements really stood out. And this allowed me to really see some of the things that I had missed in meditation before, such as the stages of the progress of insight. I was able to see patterns more clearly, and the mundaneness or the boringness of my visuals compared to some other practitioners who were seeing much more florid, compelling things ended up being of benefit to me because it allowed me to build a vocabulary that helped me really understand the progress of insight in a way that I couldn't hope to before. It was also really interesting to look at the expectations I brought to this practice versus what I brought to a mindfulness of breath. I didn't have nearly the same expectations going into breath meditation that I brought to the fire casino, and I'm really not sure why. So it's really worth exploring what expectations you bring up front.
Compared to everyone else, my experiences suck. Am I broken?
So as we were just discussing, there's this gigantic range, and it's the thought that you're a congenitally defective meditator, that your visual graphics card must be 15 years old, that you've got just an intrinsically inherently low res monitor, that you were just given faulty equipment, and that you will continue to have problems with this is a common in everyone. And even people who have had very impressive experiences in the past, when they start out a new retreat and they're building up concentration again, can be like, wow, I'm not seeing cool stuff like I used to. Maybe I've gotten old and stroked out some important part of my visual system or whatever. And these are just normal thoughts for people to think as they do this practice. But if one remembers Neko's triad of patience, faith, and curiosity, then hopefully, gently, slowly, tora, tora, dire, dire, as they say in India, you know, little, slowly, you will build up better concentration skills and things will hopefully start getting more interesting.
One other thing, as we've said before, is rather than waiting for things not to suck, you have to find the not sucking in them. And you really have to work at cultivating fascination, interest, become mesmerized. You really have to meet it halfway, meet it more than halfway in some cases. And that is really the project here. That's really what you are bringing to the meditation. So it's not something that is just going to dance for you. You have to really meet it.
It's all mental fabrication. So fabricate what's skillful and useful that makes you take the next step.
Absolutely. One of the things that I learned from my illuminated tradition, although I don't know if it's unique to it, is the concept of reacting to realizing that your mind has been wandering with a big fat yes, because it's at that moment that your mind woke up. And so if you reinforce it like a pat on the head of a puppy that just brought you your slippers, you're more likely to get that in the future. And so I think how we relate to frustration can actually dramatically change our progress.